Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, a podcast about the United States and the world in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. I'm your host, Michael Patrick Cullinane. Welcome back to the show. In 1901, Mark Twain wrote one of his most haunting satires. It was called To the Person Sitting in Darkness, and he jokingly referred to the Filipinos and the Chinese as those sitting in the darkness or uncivilized, and he referred to the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions as the Lightbringers. Twain saw the missionaries as agents of American empire abroad, the same as the U.S. government. And incidentally, he referred to President McKinley as the chairman of the Blessings of Liberty Trust, a profitable trading monopoly in the colonies. So missionary work, according to Twain, had as much to do with American empire as commerce and notions about spreading democracy. So why, then, has it taken so long to get this story into the historiography? Historian Marilyn Young, years ago, back in the 1970s, complained about the absence of missionary work in our reckoning with empire. Well, finally, we have the book to put this right. Today, I am joined by Dr. Emily Conroy Crutz, who is the author of Missionary Diplomacy, Religion and 19th Century American Foreign Relations. Emily is professor of history at Michigan State University and the author of Christian Imperialism, Converting the World in the Early American Republic. In 2022, she won the Stuart Burnett Lecture Prize from the Society of Historians of American Foreign Relations, which for diplomatic historians is like the Screen Actors Guild Award. It's a huge award. And this book has been in the works for some time, she tells me. It does not disappoint. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, well, I always think it's good to start with scene setting, especially with a book that is so big. It's a century long of coverage of missionaries. So let's set the scene. At the outset of the 19th century, how many missionaries are working overseas, and how does that figure change by the end of the century? And also, if you could say, what do they do and where do they do their work?
Numbers are not my strong suit too. So it's in the beginning of the century, we're talking about, in 1812, American missionaries, a couple hundred over the next, growing over the next few decades. The numbers really jump after the Civil War, particularly because at that point there are women's mission boards that are started up. And so you have huge numbers of single women who are going out in mission work from the 1870s onwards. But we're talking thousands by the turn of the century. Increasingly more denominations as the century goes on as well.
And what are they doing? Because it's not the same everywhere. And where are they doing it? I mean, I know we can generally say the developing world, I guess.
Yeah, they're all over the place. And quite early on. So by 1840, there are American missionaries in South Asia, East Asia, the West and South Africa, the Middle East, the Pacific Islands, little bits in Latin America. And of course, also in North America, working with various indigenous nations. And that will spread increasingly in the Mediterranean region. Numbers in Asia will really jump. Coverage in Africa will really jump. More in Latin America as the century goes on. More in the Pacific as the century goes on. So they're sort of all over the place. And the thing that's really, really was striking as I was working on this project was sort of mapping out where are the missionaries versus where are the officials of the U.S. state. And one of the things that became very clear very quickly is that missionaries have a slightly different geography than the U.S. Diplomatic service, than the consular service as well. And so you've got missionaries are able to sort of focus on places in what they will call the heathen world, or occasionally the non-Christian world, but they use really denigrating language to describe a lot of these places in much of their writing. And the state is really focusing on Europe, on Latin America for the first half of the century. And so missionaries kind of become the sort of American experts on the ground and will be pulling the state behind them for the second half of the century, where once we get to the Gilded Age and Progressive Era that all of your listeners are most interested to, sort of those dynamics get really messy and super interesting.
Yeah, super interesting. And largely because diplomats didn't have they didn't have the money to go into these places. The U.S. government didn't fund embassies until later in the 19th century. There were missions and legations, right? I mean, you make that distinction in your book, I think, which is wonderful. But let's just go back to the Civil War, because you mentioned the Civil War. And in your book, you make the point of saying that the Civil War kind of changed everything, that there was exponential growth in missionary activity after that. Why? Why is it after that point?
That's a great question. I think partly it has to do, if we're thinking within there's a religious history answer to that, and there's probably a diplomatic history answer to that, right? And I'd say the religious history answer is that before the Civil War, a lot of the conversations within denominations there's a lot of infighting, of course, over the question of slavery and how the denominations are going to respond to this, you know, huge domestic political question. And so absolutely, missions are going out. Presbyterians are sending out missions. The Congregationalists are sending out missions. The Methodists and the Baptists, and all of them are engaging in this work. But they are also, you know, fighting with each other a lot over these big questions. After the Civil War, they are sort of able to sort of push outward a little bit more after those earlier questions get kind of put on pause, sort of more than fully resolved. And from the diplomatic side, we see a real growth because, you know, the post-Civil War period, it's this increasing centralization of the federal government in all kinds of ways, including in its sort of diplomatic and sort of outward reaching forms. And that's going to create sort of more possibilities for this kind of mission work. And missionaries will... very much in this period are in the mode of, you know, you give them an inch and they'll take a mile. So as soon as you see a little bit more presence in, say, China and Japan and Korea, the missionaries are going to be there, and they are going to be going to the absolute extent of where anyone could possibly interpret those treaties and, you know, doing as much as they can.
Yeah, great, great answer. And your book is going to delve into that relationship with the state more and more as things get more institutionalized, I guess. But the institution at the heart of this story as well is the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. This is the NGO that has, I suppose, a lot to answer for in a lot of ways with missionary work. I mean, who are they and why do they come about and into being?
So the ABCFM is one of the largest missionary organizations in the 19th century. I'd say they're joined probably by the Presbyterians in sort of their numbers and their extent, and then maybe the Methodists. But the ABCFM is founded in 1810, so they're also the first American Foreign Missionary Society, initially founded sort of to bring together Congregationalists and sort of Christian Reformed denominations. A few Presbyterians start out in there in the very early 19th century, but then the Presbyterian denomination forms their own groups. And what they are... sort of from the very beginning, sort of understanding themselves as somewhat connected to a British missionary tradition in sort of going out and civilizing and Christianizing the world. And so that's really key, right? Is that they are not just doing evangelistic work, not just proselytizing, but also building institutions like schools, like hospitals, printing presses are really important as well. And they're going to be sort of joined in that sort of emphasis by the Presbyterians in particular. So these sort of the institutional work that they do is really key. They're based in this period, the ABCFM is based in Boston. The Presbyterians are in Philly, and they are sort of the leadership of those organizations is very interested in creating connections with Washington, D.C., with sort of strengthening relationships with Washington, D.C., and sort of creating a place for these missionaries to have a real influence on sort of what the American state is doing and where it is taking part in activities around the world.
All right, I'm gonna have to come back to the religious right in the present day and the ABCFM, but that is a question I have too about how these organizations kind of lobby the US. I also wonder what motivates them, and your book is really good in this. Obviously, you know, there's the idea of saving souls from fire and brimstone. That explains part of it, perhaps. But what your book explains is how the ideas of the Enlightenment really hastened the rise of these missionaries. So I wonder if you could say something a little bit more about the motivations and inspirations for the growth of these groups.
Yeah, I think it's a really helpful framing that you just gave. The motivation in part is the easy answer, and the sort of the answer that they would give you, which is probably not the true answer, but the answer that they would give you is that they're responding to a biblical mandate, a scriptural mandate to go into the world and teach all the nations. This is called the Great Commission in the New Testament that Jesus gives to the apostles. And so they understand that sort of their kind of Protestant Christianity demands them to take action in the world to bring as many people as possible into knowledge of what they call true Christianity. And so the motivation for sort of going out and doing all of this work that they're doing, whether we're talking about proselytizing or schools or hospitals, it is, you know, at its heart, it's about saving souls. It's about sort of improving people's lives. It's about, you know, bringing people to knowledge of the truth. That said, of course, right, their understanding of how all of that works is deeply colored by ideas about sort of hierarchical understandings of civilization, by understandings of race, understandings of sort of proper gender roles, and things like this. And so they are really trying to go out and sort of transform the world in their own image. And they understand that sort of Protestantism as practiced in the Northeastern United States for most of these folks I'm talking about, right? That is the, that is true Christianity. And they are thus trying to spread not just their sort of theological ideas, but also their cultural practices, their ways of seeing the world. They understand that the spread of U.S. commerce, the spread of U.S. power is going to further their interests as well. Yeah, motivations are hard to get at, right? But it's sort of some combination of that stuff. And over the course of the century, the extent to which sort of the civilizing mission is tied to evangelism, you know, shifts. It'll shift depending on which denomination we're talking about as well. But that core idea, I think, is pretty consistent, particularly in the groups that get connected to the State Department in the ways that I study in the book.
I mean, just listening to you, it does remind me of this sort of, a broad consensus among diplomatic historians that this is part of a bigger story of empire, whether we're thinking back to the 60s and Walter Lefebvre's book, The New Empire, or whether we're thinking about Marilyn Young explicitly saying that we haven't talked enough about gender, race, and the church and religion, among many other things. I think yours definitely your book plugs this gap here, too. It also reminds me of a book by David Brody about Orientalism and how material culture and ideas flow from East to West and West to East through, I suppose, ideas. I mean, Michael Hunt talks about this, of course, in his work as well. But Brody's book, the reason why I thought of yours is because you use this term missionary intelligence, which is the first time I've heard it. And I'm guessing that you've penned that. I love it, not least because we had a show a few weeks back about military intelligence, which we all know what that means. But what does it mean to you, and why is it important to the book, and why is it important to the broader story of American empire?
Yeah, I wish I could say I coined it, but I actually stole it from them. It's their term. And it's really powerful precisely because it speaks to, right, it sounds like military intelligence. It sounds like all of these other, and that was intentional, right? By the, during World War I, they shift the language to, what is the word they use? Missionary ammunition.
That's not a good one at
all. It's horrible. It's just, but it's really, they're trying to sort of evoke some of these ideas. I drew it out in the book so much, I think, because it is so key to understanding what they're doing in the U.S., right? Because their motivation to go out is based on, right, that Great Commission idea, right? They're also doing work in the United States and trying to create an audience that will support this work, that will agree that this work is important, that will donate their money and their time and, over the generations, their labor. And they are very astute in the, as early as the 1820s, 30s, we see them talking about this, that the problem that is facing, these sort of globally engaged missionaries who want to encourage Americans to think about the world is that Americans are, and again, this is their language, ignorant. Americans don't know enough about the world. And what they know about the world is stereotypical and wrong. And so the missionaries replace those stereotypes with their own stereotypes, right? But are positioning themselves as global experts who, unlike any other Americans at the time, are spending the rest of their lives in these foreign spaces, living alongside ordinary people, speaking the language. And so they are writing a ton in these incredibly diverse genres to sort of inform an American audience and prepare an American audience to understand why they should care about the world, which places around the world they should care about, what people around the world they should care about, and to get them really engaged in sort of becoming more globally connected over time. And so this is a really explicit project throughout the century, and it starts really, really early. And so they'll, and they will label these sort of articles in the mission press, but also in sort of the mainstream secular media, sort of missionary intelligence. Letters coming in from the field.
How do they wind up getting from, so what you're saying is that really they're translators. I mean, obviously we know that they do work as translators too, but they're translating the outside world, the foreign, into the domestic United States. How do they win the support of the U.S. government? I mean, you take a look at, you've got a great long passage about John Quincy Adams and the growing influence of missionaries on his thinking. Maybe you could tell us that story, because that's a really great one for explaining how the U.S. government really gets won over.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, the John Quincy Adams stuff, I love it. He's so fun. And it's always interesting to spend time in his diaries. And what really struck me about him was some of these missionaries, I think when they come back to the States, they actually preach and lecture in front of Congress. And so one of the missionaries I was tracing, I knew he had given a sermon in front of Congress, and I was trying to find a transcript or someone reflecting on it, and I couldn't find anything anywhere until I looked in John Quincy Adams' diaries. And I was like, oh, this is fascinating, because Adams is someone who I think is probably the most globally informed American of his time, for sure, perhaps of the century. I mean, I think that's probably debatable, but maybe. He spent his entire career in working in American diplomacy and reading about the world, thinking about the world. Right? He is not a person I had really expected to see affected by missionary intelligence. And yet we see him, as I sort of dug into his diary and sort of looking at sort of who he was meeting and who he was encountering at various points in the career, he is also reading this missionary intelligence. He's meeting with missionaries when they're traveling through DC, whether it's during his time as Secretary of State or his time as president or his time in Congress. Missionaries are meeting with him, are sort of sharing their ideas, they're sharing their they're trying to get him on side, particularly China missionaries who are wanting to get the US more involved over there. And the thing that struck me as I was looking at his reflections is that, you know, sometimes he's not a fan. He doesn't always like the missionaries. He isn't always convinced by their arguments. But sometimes he is, you know, he finds them compelling and he finds them convincing. And again, particularly China is a place where he is really, missionaries like Peter Parker in particular are really influential on his thinking later in his career. And I think that helps us to see the ways that, you know, this stuff is all over the place in American culture at the time. Right? Missionary intelligence is seeping into spaces that where we might not expect it, that it's not just an evangelical sort of pro-mission audience who is reading this stuff. It's also sort of coming into, again, so the mainstream press, it's coming into political conversations. Right? Missionaries are positioning themselves to make sure that that happens. And at times it is influencing, you know, not just, you know, consuls abroad because, right, the Americans are the ones, the missionaries are the ones who are there, right? But also in DC, when we have sort of, you know, competing ideas about what the US should do in different places, right? Missionaries are sort of one of the blocks that is trying to influence conversation about what kinds of action should be taken and what the US ought to be doing.
That's a great answer. I mean, it does kind of beg another question here though, about like, not every government officer is equal. Like John Quincy Adams is an unexpected, fan of these writings because it helps inform his perspective of the world. But I'm interested too in how other presidents, other secretaries of state, you talk about Seward, for example, quite a bit. Also political parties, how do they react to missionary work? Because your book points out that the American public in this period is generally in favor of the missionary work. And it's in a lot of cases enthusiastic about it, but the leaders find it more problematic. So what interests these American leaders and how do they react to the work that's going on?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. This sort of split between this sort of difference between what an American public and what the state can do, I think in part has to do with sort of balancing out the interests between sort of wanting the U.S. to be a moral leader in the world and wanting the U.S. to be able to trade with the world and be at peace with foreign powers. And that is, that's the tension we see over the course of the 19th century, for sure. And missionaries are a big part of sort of threading the needle there. In terms of sort of how different individual presidents respond, how different individual parties respond. In part, I mean, biography matters a lot here, right? By the end of the book, I'm, you know, talking about Wilson, who's incredibly supportive of a lot of these missionary ideas, which, you know, by that point really sound a lot like his sort of internationalism and they work together really well. Teddy Roosevelt is a really interesting transitional figure here, because he is at once, theoretically interested in some of the causes that they're embracing, while also, you know, very much not wanting to commit the U.S. to take action that it can't, that it can't deliver on. And one of my favorite TR moments is when he's very frustrated at an American woman missionary has been sort of taken hostage and they have to figure out what to do. This woman named Ellen Stone. And he's furious because, you know, what Roosevelt says, and Seward had sort of had a similar kind of argument earlier in the century is that, you know, what missionaries need to understand is that as they're going out in the world and they're doing their work, they are, trying to change things abroad, right? They have to understand that that work is intentionally risky, right? That it's not supposed to be safe. And so as much as missionaries have, you know, from the very beginning insisted that the government needs to protect them as American citizens going about on legitimate business abroad, right? We start to see some pushback from like the 1870s forward with this argument, right? That missionaries are intentionally taking on this dangerous work. And so Roosevelt is pretty funny about this with Ellen Stone, because, you know, he believes that, but also she's a woman. And so, you know, there's this wonderful furious letter he sends off where, you know, can just hear his voice being just incredibly irritated that, you know, because she's a woman, they have to do something to protect her. But these missionaries really need to know better, sort of balancing the lines between how these sort of, you know, proto-humanitarian ideas, you know, more economic concerns, right? It's a classic story of diplomacy, and sort of centering missionaries in our story, I think, helps us to really see the ways that that dynamic changes over the course of the century and sets us up for the 20th century.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Three.
So there's two things there that I want to kind of piggyback on. One is the rights of Americans abroad, which I'll come to in a second. But another one just came to me now. I mean, I just finished reading your book yesterday, so this is pretty fresh in my mind. But when I think about modern cultural diplomacy, the closer the state is to the culture, so to speak, right? You know, like, for example, promoting Satchmo to go out into the world and play jazz as a cultural export from America to, you know, to show the Cold War block that, you know, that America has got this great progressive culture. The more state involvement, the more it loses its authenticity. And I don't know, did you think about that at all with missionary work? The closer the state is, because it seems the missionaries are pulling the state in more and more. Do the people that are being, their souls are being saved, do those people go, this isn't the real thing? This is an American bastardization, or, you know, it's an inauthentic brand of a faith. Does that come across in any of their sort of perception of the missionaries?
You know, that is such a good question. And I wish I had the sort of sources and language skills to get into it in a really in-depth way. But you know, from what I have seen, you know, yes, of course, they are understanding American missionary work to be, you know, the religion that Americans are preaching is very much connected to American government power and American economic power and colonial, you know, and in some places sort of assumed to be connected to British colonial power as well, right? And so there is certainly, you know, those who are resistant to missions will sort of be rejecting it as an imperial, you know, an imperial force and a colonial force.
The closer the state seems to get, the more and more it does seem to not seem like the real deal. But the other thing that you raised was about what rights missionaries have abroad. And in an era without passports, how do missionaries claim expat rights? I mean, how do they claim American citizenship abroad?
Yeah, I mean, it's close connections to consuls is part of it, right? And also, one of the things I found really striking as I went through some of these is just displays of the American flag in really interesting ways. So Ellen Stiller, who I mentioned before, would often wear the flag as part of her dress. There's a great moment for missionary Jonas King, who's also serving as a consul at the time, where he sort of brings out the American flag to try and calm down some unrest in his home when he was being criticized for his preaching against the Eastern Church. But there is, you know, it's also, it connects sort of on a day-to-day basis when missionaries are getting into trouble and finding themselves needing the protection of the state, which happens, you know, all the time in all kinds of ways. They are identifying themselves as American citizens and reaching out to the U.S. government and saying, whether it's the consuls, whether it's sort of passing captains on ships that are going through, saying, you know, we are American citizens and we need the government to step in, we need the Navy to step in, we need some kind of protection here. And that's really key because citizenship is being worked out over the course of this whole century, right? So it's not just missionaries who are unsure what their rights are abroad. Right, this is a question for sailors, and it's a question for merchants, and it'll be a thing for tourists later in the century and journalists. Missionaries are part of that group early in the century who is sort of in real time trying to figure this sort of thing out. So there's a moment in the 1830s when, you know, in Hawaii, there's a conflict with the French who sort of a French captain has sort of declared to the American consul that, you know, if he ends up having to open fire on Hawaii, he will, you know, he will protect the American citizens, but not the missionaries because they have given up their Americanness by their connection with the kingdom. And the missionaries, of course, have a very different understanding of what their rights were and what their citizenship status was, but there's a flurry of letters back and forth. There's going to be questions sort of ongoing about what kinds of, you know, do the children of missionaries, if they're born abroad, are they going to be U.S. citizens, right? That's not something that's clear earlier in the 19th century. It gets worked out over the course of the century. In all of these writings, when missionaries are articulating their citizenship status, is that they describe themselves as Americans on legitimate business. And that language should really stand out to us. And they compare themselves over and over again to merchants, that they should be treated just like merchants who are understood by everyone, you know, when they are abroad for their work, to be American citizens who deserve protection. And, you know, missionaries are not really like merchants, actually. And so this becomes this big, I think for us, a really interesting sort of rhetorical choice that they're making as they are sort of saying, you need to protect us in this particular kind of way. Because what it's sort of identifying, first of all, is that, you know, proselytizing work is something that the U.S. government needs to protect. Missionaries describe this as, you know, part of religious freedom over and over again, which leads to all kinds of conflicts at various points that I talk about in the book. And so the understanding there, right, is that this, the government is sort of bound to support their explicitly religious work. And they, I can sort of stop there. We can get into more.
You refer to conflict, and I think the conflicts are that also, I should say as well, the book is a broad study of many regions. I mean, New Guinea, China, the Ottoman Empire, all over the world. This is not a small case study of places. This is, you know, this is impressive. But the troubles, as you call them, the missionary troubles, are as vast as the coverage of the book. So what are they? What are these troubles? How do they further involve the United States government in affairs overseas? And how do they differ from region to region? If you can just say a little bit about that, because I know there's missing heads in China, and then there's hostage shaking elsewhere, and the violence isn't quite the same. So maybe you could say something about that as well.
Yeah, so missionary troubles look, they look different depending on where you are, absolutely. And they are everywhere. And that's the term that sort of shows up in some of the State Department sort of paperwork, sort of describing the correspondence they're hearing from these missionary societies, is that all of it gets lumped together by them as missionary troubles. And so it can be, you know, in the Ottoman Empire, some of the missionary troubles are Bibles being seized and the missionary press being shut down because of regulations about sort of publication and sort of religious versus scientific texts and sort of requirements about, you know, books needing to be examined before they can be published. And so the, you know, missionaries reach out to the consul, who sort of eventually reaches out to Washington, trying to address this problem. And there they identify themselves as, you know, the largest booksellers in the region, you know, which they are, but they are also, of course, missionaries. So there's stuff like that where sort of local laws are sort of getting in the way of certain kinds of missionary labor. But then there's violence, and there's violence of various kinds. So I guess to stick in the Ottoman Empire for another minute, right, there are cases where missionaries will be attacked on the road. And it doesn't seem to be particularly about sort of them as missionaries being attacked, right? It's sort of, and so there, you know, the sort of victimhood of missionaries is pretty clear. And so the state gets involved in trying to, they're trying to make sure that the, you know, those guilty are held accountable, and often sort of held accountable in dramatic and public and quite punitive ways to sort of give an example to not attack any future Americans. That the power of the U.S. is going to be behind its citizens. In some other places, though, you have attacks on missionaries that are very clearly about them being missionaries. You know, for example, there's a murder of some missionaries in Mexico that seems to be very much a matter of sort of tension between the Protestant missionaries sort of fighting against sort of the Catholic priests in the area. In China, there's going to be a lot of attacks on missionaries. It's very much sort of both about their religious, but also their colonial power. And in China, what is really interesting as well is that it's not just American missionaries who are being attacked. Of course, it's Americans sort of being lumped in with all of these other foreign missionaries who are sort of collectively creating these kinds of problems. And one of the really striking sort of moments there is that the, you know, the, some of these, talk about them, I think, as maybe as riots, even attacks on church buildings and orphanages in particular seems to arise in part out of concern about what is happening to the children in boarding schools and in orphanages, and what are these missionaries doing to those children? And you can see there, right, a real sense of concern about sort of the increasing imperial presence of sort of the Americans, the French, the British in the area. And again, missionaries reach out to the state to try and get involved. And, you know, in those China examples, really interestingly, it's one of the questions becomes, one of the big examples there is, no Americans were harmed. It was an attack on a French mission. And what the U.S. has to decide basically is how much of this was about France, how much of this was about Christianity, how much of this was about sort of an anti-foreign presence in general, and where, you know, depending on how you answer any of those questions, it's going to be a different kind of diplomatic response for what the U.S. has to do. So these troubles sort of emerge in different ways. And the thing that is sort of striking over the course of the century, sort of after the 1870s into the 1880s and 90s, there's a shift in sort of assuming that the missionaries are victims to occasionally understand that these missionaries are causing the problems, that they are troublemakers as much as people who get sort of swept up in trouble. And so this is where we get, you know, Roosevelt's frustration at Ellen Stone and others, the sense that missionaries are sort of intentionally putting themselves in harm's way and then sort of demanding that the state come and save them when they get into trouble, and that this is not how it should work.
You mentioned China there, and I just wanted to pause because China does seem like a unique case in the rest of this. You know, there's sort of like there's troubles that happen in some places, and it's largely contained to either an American or a French or, you know, maybe two foreign nations. But China is a case where there are many nations with not just missions, but many other inter-imperial interests, whether it's trade and commerce and building railroads and ports or other things. But it's also the place where the United States, for the first time, reacts collectively with other nations, other imperial nations in the Boxer Rebellion. And that seems to be a really unique trouble, so to speak, in which American foreign policy is changed by China's decision to effectively retaliate against foreign influence in the country. Is that fair?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that is, telling the story for so many decades is we can see that this is both about, right, the increasing American bureaucratization of the state and connections to the mission movement and stuff, but also, declining power of China over the course of this century. And those things intersect in really, really powerful ways. One of the things that really sort of matters to this story, of course, is that as the U.S. is making its treaties with China, that sort of most favored nation status really matters, because that means that every time another country is making a new treaty, then sort of what the U.S. is allowed to do expands as well. And so missionaries are very attuned to changing treaty law because it affects where they can go. So there's, more and more ports being opened over the course of the century. But some of these treaties also allow for, and this is because missionaries are translators and are in the room, because missionaries are part of these treaty negotiations in the U.S. case and others. Missionaries are a slightly different group, as opposed to diplomats who are, have to be in certain places. The missionaries are, in some of these treaties, have the right to itinerate more into the interior. And missionaries interpret some of these treaties to say that they have the right, in fact, to reside in the interior and to buy property in the interior. And so that's where we see a lot of these troubles emerging over the course of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and then into the Boxer Uprising. And it's, in part, there's a mistranslation of a French treaty that sort of leads to some of these problems for the missionaries. Seward just is at the end of his rope with much of this. But the thing that really sort of struck me with sort of the sort of looking at the sort of embassy records in China was that there was a real desire to respond collectively with other powers. There was the sense that sort of for these missionary troubles and all kinds of other things as well, right? The U.S. is not alone. The U.S. interests in the region are tied to other national interests or other imperial interests in the region, I should say. And so the, you know, a lot of the instructions from D.C. are saying, you know, stand back, you know, don't join in these multinational sort of actions against China. And but actually sort of in Beijing, there is a real push to work together. And so you see this sort of tension between sort of the directions from the metropole and sort of action on the ground for how to respond to what's going on in China. And, you know, it, I think that really makes sense, particularly in the missionary case, because it's it is not clear to a lot of the Chinese people that the missionaries are encountering, you know, the distinctions between an American and a British or a French Christian, you know, not totally clear. And so there you see a real, you know, Americans are, you know, getting into trouble in part because of assumptions about things the French are doing, right? These things are all getting lumped together in ways that are a little different than what we see elsewhere. There's some more overlap as well in the Middle East. There's going to be some cooperation, particularly with the British and at various places around the world. But China is, I think, because we are seeing sort of the a really dramatic decrease in Chinese power over the course of the century, particularly in this turn of the century moment. It's all of these dynamics that we can see elsewhere are really concentrated here.
I mean, one of the things I don't want to dwell too much on the sort of imperial side of things, but you know, because there does seem to be something indispensable about the missionaries as well and the work that they're doing, which you dedicate a whole chapter to the quote unquote work of missionaries, and you know, they fund healthcare, education. We've talked a lot about translation and other services, but you know, there's that element of it too. And how does that get expressed? I mean, obviously to the American people, it gets expressed through the writings that come back, travelogues, et cetera. I mean, how does it get expressed to the people of these countries other than through the services? Is there a sort of a gratefulness for the missionaries in part? Is it a tension between grateful and, you know, this is overstretching?
Yeah, both, I think, is the true answer, right? And so it's, if you talk to, I think if you look at some of the, you know, there's certainly a lot of studies about this in sort of localized studies that get really sort of in-depth and multilingual in the 19th and the 20th centuries. And if you talk to folks who've graduated from sort of mission schools that still exist today, right, it's complicated. It's really, really complicated. And it was then, it is now. Because the kinds of, you know, why are parents sending their children to these schools in the first place? It's that it provides all kinds of opportunities for economic betterment. And that's very much their intention. So I talk in the book about Robert College a fair amount. And there's this really interesting sort of argument that emerges sort of in the lead up to founding that school about what kinds of schools missions should set up and should they be, we talk about a sort of industrial education or should they be academic mainly. And one of the things that that we see really, you know, clearly there is the missionaries are you know, supporting this sort of industrial education model is that they are raising people up from poverty. They are giving people the kinds of skills that they will need to do work to sort of feed their families in really sort of immediate and powerful ways. And that's true. And yet, right, these schools are also very much designed to sort of bring folks into the mission orbit, to create a captive audience to And to, you know, in many places, right, sort of prepare people for working for the colonial state, right? All of this is true. And so it's really, you know, it's messy, but I think that's where it gets really, really interesting. Hospitals are also, I think, a really, really interesting space for this because of that sort of captive audience angle is really dramatic there. It's, I think, easy for, and the State Department will, and sort of other sort of Americans at home will talk about these hospitals, right, as, you know, purely about medical good, purely about benevolence and humanitarianism and things like this. They'll also often talk about this as a secular work that the missions are doing. That language will get tossed around quite a bit, but they are, you know, printing scripture on the other side of prescription sheets. They are sending, when they come check on you in your home, right, they are sending someone to pray with you. There are what are called Bible women who are in the waiting rooms who are giving public prayer and Bible study while you wait for your appointment, right? So this is very much a, right, both things are happening at once, that there's this sort of so-called secular work is tied in completely with the sort of evangelical aspects of the mission.
And I guess, you know, this is why the missions endure. Because we can see that injecting Christian morality into China or the Middle East or Africa or wherever does not lead directly to a more peaceful world or even a more moral world. You know, violence, imperialism, exploitation, we're all talking about this now. That continues, it might even increase. But I guess this is an explanation, and maybe this is why it's interesting. This is an explanation for why the missions endure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You don't have to say any more about that, but I mean, I think
you said it right. Yes.
I think your book does a good job of explaining that. I suppose the follow-up question to that is that, okay, they do endure. What impact do you think your book will have, if any, on missionary work today? Because it still exists today. There are still religious missions all over the developing world. I'm saying that I think there's a hypocrisy there. I think your book talks about it, and yet they endure. So do you think your work will have any influence on today's missionary work?
I hope that those who are engaged in mission work right now will read the book and be interested to sort of think about this longer history. I hope that those who are not engaged in mission work will read the book and be able to identify some of the ways that sort of religious organizations have had a long-term influence on what the places that we are told to pay attention to around the world and the issues that we are told to pay attention to around the world and what the U.S. is what the U.S. is doing. So I hope that folks will find a lot of food for thought. In terms of sort of affecting the sort of ongoing work of missions, a couple of things are true. Right? One is that the sort of shape of missions have changed now, in large part because the sort of over the course of the 20th century, there's been a growth of short-term missions, which is very different from these 19th century folks that I talk about. And so the numbers are something like a million Americans a year are taking part in international Christian missions in some form or another. So like those numbers are way beyond the numbers of Americans who were involved in the 19th century. But the thing that's really important about that is that those Americans who are going on these short-term missions are sort of have a similar sense, I think, that they are getting to know those places in a sort of deep and real way. And Melanie McAllister talks about this beautifully in her book as well. What I hope that talking about sort of missionary intelligence in the 19th century can help us to understand a little bit is sort of the flaws in that thinking that sort of a short engagement in this very particular way can sort of give you expertise on what a certain part of the world is like. I'll leave it there. I don't know. I'm a 19th century person. I get a little nervous about talking about the present, but I think that that is, I hope that we'll see folks being a little bit more attuned to the ways that sort of these that religious organizations can sort of have a profound influence on sort of what we are told to pay attention to about the world, and who we are told to pay attention to in the world.
Emily, thanks. I think that was a great way to wrap things up. And I so appreciate you joining me on the show. And I just think your book is wonderful. And I know it's going to make a big splash in, obviously, religion has already made a big splash over the last 20 years in history, generally diplomatic history, certainly. But I think this adds a real, it plugs a major gap in the scholarship. And so thanks for that.
Thank you so much. That's really kind.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thanks for listening. You can follow the Gilded Age and Progressive Era on Twitter or on my website, michaelpatrickcullinane.com. Please consider subscribing or reviewing the podcast wherever you listen, because it really makes a big difference and helps direct others to the show. I hope you'll join me again for the next episode.